Hello, everyone. This is the Stark Truth on Countercurrents Radio. I'm your host, Robert Stark. My guest for today is TJ Parcell. He's a human rights activist. It's nice having you on the show.
Well, thank you for having me on the show, Robert.
So I guess what we can talk about is you have a film coming out. Is it out yet, or are you still working on it?
No, I've completed a short film called Zuzus and Wham Whams, based on my book Fish, a memoir of a boy in a man's prison. It's a 22-minute short film. I'm now submitting it to film festivals, and I'm working on raising the funds to do the feature film.
And the making of that, the short film, so it was filmed at the actual prison that the book takes place.
My book Fish, a memoir of a boy in a man's prison, is based on my experience as a teenager. I was 17 years old and I robbed a photo mat with a toy gun. It landed me in an adult prison for 4.5 to 15 years. And while I was in there, I experienced sexual violence, and I set out about 10 years ago to start writing the book and to try to put a human face on a very tragic condition in our judicial system, and that's more specifically being sending juveniles into adult prisons. So I sat down and I wrote a book about my experience and what happened and how I was able to survive it. And then about 4 years ago, after my book came out, I was approached by a couple of film producers to option the rights for the story. And I was very uncomfortable about giving the material over to someone else and trusting that they would do a good job with it. We've all seen seen plenty of examples of good books that were turned into terrible movies. So I thought, well, if anybody's going to ruin it, I think I'd rather do that myself. Or at least, you know, try to, you know, do the story justice. So I got into the NYU grad film program, and for the last 3.5-4 years, I've been working up to being able to do the feature. So in my first year in the program, I did a 9-minute short film, and then last year I completed a 21-minute short, which we went back to the very prison I was in Michigan, and shot it over 7 days.
And was the prison there still in work, and were there staff there, or what? It was shut down?
Well, it was mostly shut down. There's still a section of it that's still operational, and there's a new prison that's adjacent to it. But the section that I was in 30 years ago was closed. And I was online doing some research about the Michigan tax credits, and they have these programs to attract filmmakers to the state of Michigan, where they offer, you know, a number of attractive incentives to bring your production to the state. And as I was reading up about it, I noticed a little piece of legislation that had made state properties available to filmmakers free of charge. And I knew they had just closed that section, so I thought, oh, my God, that's perfect. So I got on the phone with the state and started negotiations with them. We had to, because it was adjacent to a section that was still operational, and because it was next to a prison that was fully functioning, we had to hire and pay overtime for some of the corrections officers to be there to kind of make sure that we weren't, you know, trying to help convicts escape or something.
So did you use actual guards in the film?
No, we didn't. Yes and no. We shot a fairly large production. There were about 200 people involved, and there were some corrections officers on their day off that came and volunteered to be extras in the film. So there is one corrections officer that we put in an actual guards uniform, but it was kind of more fun to put the guards in prison uniforms, and we made them prisoner extras.
Did you get a chance to talk to the guards about what they thought about the film?
I did. It was, it was kind of an interesting thing. I mean, I've been an activist for about 10 years and heavily involved in a lot of the activities that have been around the Prison Rape Elimination Act, and I've done quite a bit of work in Washington on, I worked with the commission and I helped lobby for passage of the bill, and I was on some standards committees that helped draft national standards that affect every federal, state, local prison. So when I made the decision to go out and do the film, I wasn't sure if my background would help or hurt. So I was very low key and quiet about my background, and it wasn't until we were literally on location, we were doing all the pre-lighting, and the guy from I forget what department it was, I think he was public communications, was the one that was actually doing the location agreement. He brought it over to me to sign, and he says, "Oh, I'm going to have to Google you tonight." And I thought, okay. And then the next day he came in and he says, "You know, I Googled you last night and realized that you're responsible for a lot of the rules we have in here now," which was pretty cool. I think, you know, by and large, they were very supportive. In fact, after that interchange, we were shooting in a part of the prison that had no heat, and they had sent over a couple of cases of these thermal uniforms that the guards use in inclement weather. They were kind of like, they look like almost snowmobile suits with the pants and, you know, the jackets. And they were very, very supportive.
Did you notice a difference with the guards when you were in prison yourself? For most of do you think the attitudes have changed?
Well, attitudes are changing. I'm happy to report that, you know, I mean, there's still a lot of work that needs to be done, but attitudes are certainly changing. Because of the Prison Rape Elimination Act, there's not an agency in the country that's not dealing with this issue on one level or another. There's been a lot of work that's gone into training and working on expanding attitudes. It used to be that the guards just accepted prisoner rape as part of the environment and that there wasn't a lot you could do about it. And in fact, there is a lot that can be done about it, and there's a lot that's being done about it now. The biggest, I think, hurdle has been, getting the states to, take responsibility and say, we are going to adopt a zero tolerance attitude, and we're not going to, allow silent screams in the night, not respond to allegations of rape or to do reasonable things like making sure that you're not putting nonviolent criminals with the more violent predatory criminals. I mean, we know who the more predatory inmates tend to be and who the more vulnerable inmates tend to be. So, simple things like just classification and having procedures and protocols in place to respond to allegations of rape and to make sure that, when someone comes forward and says, you know what, I've been raped, that the agency responds and holds the people that were responsible accountable.
And the other issue is a lot of the inmates are scared of retaliation, or if they snitch, that they'll get killed.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, the weaker inmates are raped, but the snitches are killed. So there is a code of silence in prison that is very real. And but I think that's it's why it's so important that the states adopt this zero tolerance attitude towards sexual violence, and that they're demonstrating leadership in terms of not tolerating and accepting it, because there are inmates in the past who have come forward and said, look, I've been raped, and they were, the guards and the administration failed to respond, and then just sent them back out there. And so it communicated to the inmates that, you know, it's okay.
Did you personally ever try to report it to the guards?
No. No, I was afraid to. I was afraid that, one, I was afraid that I'd be killed, and two, I was not all that confident that they would do anything about it. I did have an experience in the county jail where I was being pressured in a bullpen, and I went to the deputy, and the deputy at the front of the gate wasn't going to do anything, and then I, when they opened the gate to let another inmate out, I ran out and started screaming, and there was a sergeant that took some pity on me, but you know, frankly, I think that, you know, that deputy that I first went to and failed to respond is just as guilty as the guys in the bullpen.
And were you housed, if you were viewed as nonviolent, they didn't differentiate between violent and nonviolent offenders, or they saw your crime as because it was, they considered it armed robbery, they therefore housed you with violent offenders?
Well, it's twofold. I mean, there's two dimensions to this point. The fact that it was a toy gun had no bearing on whether or not it was still considered an armed robbery. So it was a violent offense. It was considered a violent crime. The other important factor, I think, is that I was 17 years old. I committed a serious crime, and I deserve to be punished. But I'd submit that I don't believe I deserved what I got when I arrived there, and the rape never should have been part of my penalty or part of the punishment. And I think it was irresponsible on the part of the state to put it's irresponsible to put teenagers in adult prisons with violent criminals. It's one of the things that came out of the Prison Rape Elimination Act and the standards that were issued is that, you know, that we should not do that. We should not put juveniles in with adults. And when a juvenile commits a serious crime, then there should be, a separation in terms of where they're housed. And when they're in locations with adult predatory inmates, they should be adequately supervised.
Besides juveniles, what groups are the most vulnerable?
Well, they tend to be young, weak, non-violent offenders. The gay inmates tend to be disproportionately victimized, and the mentally ill. Inmates that are not street savvy, that have no street smarts. Again, it's mostly the nonviolent first time offenders that who are, you know, kind of a fish out of water. And
is there a strong racial component to it?
Well, there's yeah, I mean, I think the white inmates tend to be more victimized than African American inmates. But there are some, there are racial lines in prison that are very, you know, a lot of the gangs are divided up among racial lines, and there are certain, rules, but certainly conventions that happen along racial lines. You're not going to see a white, typically you're not going to see a young African-American raped by a group of white inmates without there being...
So the other black inmates would retaliate?
The black inmates would retaliate. And it also depends on the size of the gangs, you know, so it's more likely that you'll have a group of African Americans that might rape a young white inmate coming in than necessarily the other way around. Just because of the minority status that white inmates occupy inside a prison. I mean, and it's also with young, even if it's a young effeminate or gay inmate, there's certain racial, I don't know what the word is, but, you know, there's a you know, it's more likely that a young African American gay inmate would be attacked by other African American inmates than necessarily by white inmates or even Hispanic inmates, without there being, you know, some racial tension.
You said are the gay rights activists involved with this issue, or you think they're kind of oblivious to it?
Well, it's been frustrating for me because the gay rights organizations have been really quiet on this issue. They've not been very active at all. In fact, during, you know, in 2002, 2003, during a lot of the lobbying efforts for the passage of the Prison Rape Elimination Act, there were no gay rights organizations involved. We started to see some involvement when the hearings were underway, once the bill was passed and the National Prison Rape Elimination Act was established a commission that spent a couple of years studying the problem. There were some gay rights groups that did provide some information, more specifically around the needs of transgender inmates. But I think, by and large, there's been an absence of gay rights groups.
And then there's the attitudes of society. One thing you pointed out is you had this experience that where you walked into a video store in New York, and they were watching some TV show. I think was it the show on HBO Oz?
Yeah, it was a past episode of Oz. I walked into a video store and there was this past episode playing on the monitor, and in the episode there was a young man that was raped and was forced feminized, and the guys in the store were behind the counter looking up at the monitors and laughing, and it was a real kind of defining moment for me. I think that was the final kind of decision point for me to become an activist and to start writing about this issue, because I think it's important to humanize it. And it is a human rights travesty that goes on. The fact that we would allow this kind of activity to go on and joke about it, and, you know, I mean, in this day and age, it would be, I don't know of any example now where a comedians think it's okay to joke about a rape of a woman, but still, you know, whenever there's a high profile arrest, and, you know, Sandusky is sentenced today, I'm sure there'll be jokes about it.
Yeah, I saw it with Sandusky. The thing is, it's sort of an eye for an eye kind of mentality, because he raped other people. They kind of see it as justice, and that, if you look at those comments, and that is sort of a prevailing mentality in our society.
Yeah, it's the truth is, it's barbaric. We do have an Eighth Amendment that bars against cruel and unusual punishment, and rape is certainly that. It's cruel and it's unusual, and it's not something that we should condone as a society, regardless of what somebody does. Now, I think, you know,
that's the thing. I mean, I agree with you completely, but I'm just pointing out kind of how people make exceptions. Like, some people say, oh, they're against it in most cases, but people make exceptions if they're horrified by the crime itself. But you're absolutely right. It can't be tolerated in a civilized society at all.
No, and I think, you know, Mr. Sandusky was alleged to have done is despicable, and he deserves to be punished. And what did he get, 30 to 60 years? So for a man of his age, he'll probably never see the free world again. And, you know, I mean, that's that, and, you know, what he needs to, you know, I mean, that's his punishment. He's being sent to prison as punishment, not for punishment. You know, that, you know, there's not, rape shouldn't be a part of that penalty.
I think there was a Supreme Court ruling that said that did say it was cruel and unusual punishment. Do you know the name of that?
I think it's Farmer versus Brennan, and it established something called this provision called deliberate indifference, that if the prison officials demonstrate a deliberate indifference then they're guilty of violating the cruel and unusual punishment provisions of the Constitution. But that's a fairly high standard, the deliberate indifference. There's quite a, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but as I understand it, there's quite a bit of components to have to prove that the state had demonstrated some kind of deliberate indifference to the plight of the plaintiff. And I'll give you a really good example. I testified on Capitol Hill with a mother whose 17-year-old son was sent to a Texas prison for starting a dumpster on fire. That was his only crime. He started a dumpster on fire. And a crazy judge sent him to prison for 8 years. So now this 17-year-old boy is sent to a maximum security prison in Texas, and he was immediately raped. This kid wrote several formal grievances begging for protection, begging to be removed from the housing unit, and the state did nothing, and this kid hung himself in his jail cell. That is deliberate indifference. I think that the prison administrators who failed to respond to this kid's pleas for help are just as guilty as the guys that were raping him.
And were those guards, there was never a prosecution?
No, there was not a prosecution. I don't know of any prosecution that's occurred in the U.S. where administrators were held accountable because they failed to respond to allegations of rape. We're starting to see for the first time corrections officers being prosecuted for having sex with inmates, but that's new. I mean, that is a recent development. It's a recent development that sex between guards and inmates is even a crime in most states.
Are some states worse offenders than others?
Well, California and Texas has the highest allegations of sexual violence on inmate on inmate, as well as staff on inmate. So Texas and California, but they also are two of the states with the largest prison populations.
So then there's the issue of how common it is, then there's the issue of how hard they're trying to crack down on it.
Yeah, and I you know, as I understand it, Texas has been improving. I mean, they certainly have taken a more active role as of late. They were one of the states with the worst records and some of the more egregious examples. There was another gay inmate who was being forced into prostitution in Texas, and same thing, where he filed several formal grievances, and then it wasn't until the ACLU filed a lawsuit on his behalf that the state moved to protect this guy. And this was a guy who was being, you know, forced into prostitution, and every day of his incarceration was being forced to perform sexual acts for $5 and $10.
And the legislation that passed in the Senate and was signed by the president, what are your thoughts on that? I know some people are saying that it's just collecting data and that it's not effective enough. Do you agree with that?
Well, it had several components to it. One component was the data collection. So for the first time, we are have been gathering data to try to get a handle on the prevalence of the problem. And that has different dimensions to it. So in one part, there's the administrative records collection, and then there were inmate surveys that were done. So it's progress in terms of just being able to quantify how big of an issue this is, and to also rank the states so that we can look and see which states have the highest incidences, which states have the lowest, and then try to do some additional probing to figure out why that is. You know, what are the states that have lower numbers? What are they doing differently? So the data collection was one part of it, and then the other part was the establishment of the Prison Rape Elimination Commission. And the commission spent several years studying the problem, listening to various stakeholders, and then they had written a number of standards that would affect every federal, state, local prison, jail, juvenile facility, immigration detention center. And those standards were issued by the Attorney General earlier this year in May. And so those standards carry with it a penalty where states can lose federal funding if they don't comply with those standards. And some of the things that those standards include are things like classification, the handling of juveniles, how to respond to allegations of rape, how to investigate prosecution of perpetrators.
Have there been prosecutions of the perpetrators?
We're starting to see some. I don't know that there's data that's being collected on that. It could be. I just don't know if that's being done. I have read, several cases recently where, both inmates and staff have been prosecuted for rape, which, again, that's a new development.
And about the, I think back to some of the attitudes that the public has, I think the attitude that the public has is that prison is a place to get rid of sort of undesirable people who are dangerous. So what happens in a prison doesn't affect them. But I think that's totally false because there's so many effects on society as a whole. And sort of the idea that having a violent environment is a deterrence, a lot of people have that mentality. But if anything, like most of these people, a lot of nonviolent offenders end up becoming violent when they get out just to survive. So there's so many effects on society as a whole.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you look at our growing prison populations, and we have 2.2 million prisoners in the U.S., more than any other country in the world. So, it's not necessarily working as a deterrent. But also, as you point out, the majority of prison inmates are there for nonviolent crimes. A lot of them are there for drug crimes. A lot of the run-up in the prison population has been a result of the war on drugs. Listen, I think prisons are necessary, and they house very violent people. And people commit crimes, and they should be punished, and they should go to prison. But we really do need to look at what we're doing in our prison system because it's not working. 2/3 of the inmates that get out are rearrested within 3 years, and 50% are returned within 3 years for a new crime. So our recidivism rates are off the charts. Our populations are off the charts. And, something needs to be done to address the whole culture in there. Now, prisoner rape doesn't just affect a small population of people. For a guy to avoid being raped, they have to become hyper-violent just to avoid it. And while they're in there, they take on this kind of persona where they're hyper-masculine, hyper-violent. They have to live that way to survive. And then, guess what? They're coming back out, and they're coming home into our communities, indelibly marked by what they've experienced. And after having to live a certain way for a number of months or years, we then expect them to come back out in our community and be normal.
And the thing is, you've dedicated your life to doing positive things, but I think there are other people who have gone for that have ended up doing horrible things to other people. Like, do you know about the case in Texas where that black man was dragged behind the truck? And I think it came out that there were some sadistic guards that threw that guy into a cell where he was raped, and then he viewed that as taking revenge. So I think it's a problem of people wanting to end up committing more violence, and they're going to be based on that psychological trauma.
Well, they've been. What I do know is that those guys were nonviolent offenders when they first went in, and they came out very violent. So that environment had an effect on them that was not good. I've heard it theorized that some men will come out and try to regain their masculinity in the way in which they viewed they lost it. I don't know if that's true, but it makes sense because the amount of rage that one carries with them from having suffered that kind of violence, it's got to go somewhere. And, you know, the sad thing is that most of these guys that are coming out of our prisons don't have the resources to get therapy and to process that experience in any kind of positive, healthy way. So, you know, prisoner rape is society's problem. 90% of all prisoners are eventually going to be released, and they're coming back to our communities, marked by that experience.
I'd like to thank you for being on. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, I would like to mention, plug my Kickstarter campaign for my feature film. Your listeners will go to Kickstarter.com and just search on Fish, A Boy in a Man's Prison feature film. They can see a trailer for my film and then make a small donation. The way the Kickstarter campaigns work is it's a crowdfunding source, so lots of people can make small donations and it can add up. And, you know, I'd like to make my feature film, and, you know, unfortunately, to make a film costs a lot of money. And this isn't the kind of film that'll come out of the traditional Hollywood system. So it's, going to be an independent production, and I could use help from anybody that would like to help me realize this vision of putting my story up on a big screen.
And is that up on your main website?
Well, they could go to my website, or they could go to Kickstarter.com and again, search on Fish, A Boy in a Man's Prison. You know, my goal is to, you know, just humanize this issue and tell a story that can change hearts and minds and create the ongoing political will to change the system. You know, it's very easy in the abstract to say, you know, well, you know, you don't want to be raped, stay out of prison, and they get what they deserve. And, you know, but if you can tell a story and present a character to someone and try to put a human face on it, it can change attitudes and change hearts and minds and say, you know what, no matter what somebody's done, nobody deserves that. That our system is messed up and we do need to change it.
Well, I'd like to thank you again for being on.
Well, thank you for having me, Robert. I appreciate it very much.
That was TJ Parcell talking about his upcoming film he's working on. Thanks again for being on. And that's all we have for today, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.